listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Mary Norris has worked in the New Yorker's copy department for over 30 years, and now she's written a book called Between You and Me, in which she tells the story of her decades of correcting and proofing pages of prose for a magazine that's famous for its high standards and sometimes idiosyncratic style. We spoke in April, and we're rebroadcasting that conversation for you now. Has being a copy editor changed the experience of reading for you? I know when I was a copy, when I was a proofreader, it didn't matter what I was reading. I would turn the page and I would see the typo in the middle of the page immediately before I even started reading at the top.
Well, that means you were a natural.
Well, I gave it up. But can you read without thinking, oh, gee, I would have changed that?
Well, I can now. For about the first year after I started working on the copy desk, I couldn't read anything for pleasure. It was all finding errors and typos in Faulkner and wanting to do something about it, feeling I should mark up the copy. But I got over it, thank goodness.
Reading a newspaper would have been hell. Is it fair to say that the reputation of a copy editor, particularly one at The New Yorker, is one that inspires both awe and just a little bit of trepidation in some people? You say that sometimes people recoil from you at cocktail parties when you tell them what you do.
I've been surprised, especially since the book has come out, that people who write to me or people who speak to me say, I'm a little intimidated talking to you. And I think I'm always surprised because I'm intimidated talking to anyone myself. And also I don't correct people in conversation. I wouldn't do that.
Well, if somebody makes an egregious error, do you then include that, the correct version, in your sentence, or do you just let it slide?
That is a polite way to correct somebody, and I do sometimes do that. Most of the time, they miss it.
Thinking back to your childhood, are copy editors born, or are they made?
I think a copy editor is made, I would have to say, although I did have an eye for technical details in books from the time I first began reading, I think. I used to notice that they had right-hand margins that were justified, but it took me a long time to learn how to be a copy editor. I learned by osmosis, just by reading proofs that my betters had worked on
And then asking, why did you change this or correct this?
I had people that I could go to and say, would you spell imminent this way or that way? And they would tell me pretty clearly what was the right thing to do.
It seems as if you had a pretty circuitous job path. Didn't your first job involve checking feet rather than checking copy?
Yes, it did. I was 15 and a half. I was very eager to be financially independent when I was a teenager, and there was competition to be a babysitter on the block. So I got this job at a swimming pool. It was with the Department of Recreation in Cleveland.
And why was your job title at the time Key Girl?
Well, I don't know. It was Key Personnel, and I don't know why it was called that, because we were not by any means crucial to the operation of the swimming pool. We cleaned the bathrooms, we swabbed the decks, and we had these little benches we sat at where people would come and put their toes on a foot-shaped platform. They'd put one foot at a time on the platform and spread out their toes with their fingers to show that they did not have athlete's foot and could safely enter the public swimming pool.
Then you became a milkman. Did that job prepare you for some of the pronoun gender issues you would later have to deal with as a copy editor?
Well, I guess in a way it did. I couldn't make up my mind what to call myself. I was driving a milk truck, and the milkmen, when they got to the door, would always holler, "Milkman!" And I couldn't do that. I wasn't a man. I didn't like milk lady. Mm-hmm. And I thought milkmaid would be okay, but that would be silly in 20th century America to be hollering milkmaid.
You could say milk delivery.
Could have said milk delivery. Instead, I just said milkwoman and muffled that last syllable. It was milkwoman.
You had a crash early in your career?
Oh, yes. I guess I had to put that part in. We drove the truck standing up. And there was a way that you could, there was a different set of pedals that you could sit down and use, but The chair swiveled out and had been swiveled back and forth so much that it was very loose. So I was still working with the foreman at the time, and we were driving the long drive back to the dairy. And for that, you were supposed to sit down. But we found that when I tried to make a turn, the seat would turn at the same time as the steering wheel was turned. So I would find myself facing out the side window of the truck. So the driver said, I think you'd do better standing up. And standing up and driving, there's only two pedals. You go through the clutch to the brake, and you have the accelerator. So a red light appeared just under, just as I was going under an underpass. I saw that the light had changed. And so I braked, and I was balancing on my right heel, clinging to the steering wheel, which you're not supposed to do, and I just went over. I lost my balance, and there was no real harm done. The foreman crashed into the ice cream freezer, and I landed on the floor, but I just crashed into a concrete barrier, and that was the end of that truck for a while.
But there's no crying over spilled milk. You also worked at a costume rental store. I'm trying to think of how all of these things lead one to being a copy editor at The New Yorker.
I don't know that they do. The only thing they have in common is they had some interest for me. I really did have a sincere interest in the dairy industry, and I worked at any level of it. Costumes, I had an interest in the theater. And I got to do costumes for plays and production in Cleveland and props for TV shows. And I sewed a little, so you know that brought together a few of my talents.
And were you reading The New Yorker in Cleveland?
No, I didn't start reading The New Yorker until I was in graduate school, which was after I'd gone to college in New Brunswick, New Jersey, then back home to Cleveland for a year, and then I went up to Vermont to get a master's degree. And it was while I was in graduate school that I started reading The New Yorker.
Do you remember the articles in that first issue?
I do. I remember that it was a wonderful issue. It had in it, it was this year that Woody Allen wrote the Kugel Mass episode. The Kugel Mass episode was in there. And John McPhee's series, Coming Into the Country, was serialized that year.
How did you first pick up the word and the concept of synecdoche?
That was in the McPhee that I wrote, that I read about Alaska. Yes, it was a description of somebody's window onto the wild, and he used that word. It was synecdoche, meaning it was like a window onto all of Alaska, and I'd never read the word or heard it before.
I've always associated with saying, here comes the law instead of here comes the police or something like that, where you use a different word to describe. I don't know how, if I'm saying this well.
Yes, it's the examples that the dictionary gave when I looked it up. It was the boards instead of the stage, mm-hmm. or 20 sail instead of 20 ship. So window just meant point of view, I think, there.
My guest is Mary Norris, who's written a book called Between You and Me, Confessions of a Comma Queen. We'll get to the commas in a moment. So when you applied for a job at The New Yorker, did your wide-ranging resume impress them?
They did kind of look at that. In that dairy industry, my qualifications as a dairy queen didn't go very far. They were amused at that, I think. Now, I tried to tell them that I would be a good candidate for a job because I had no preconceptions about anything and I would be able to learn New Yorker style pure.
Mm. And what was your first job at The New Yorker?
I worked in the editorial library where we took apart the magazine. It's the archive of the magazine, and we used to use razor blades and slice up the magazines into columns and paste them into individual writers' scrapbooks.
That was pre-digital, of course. There's a
yes,
whole other
was.
Skill today. You were a collator. Did that job overlap with the copy editor's job?
It did, in a sense, yes. The collator had to copy onto a clean proof changes from the proofreaders and from the fact checker and the author and the editor. And sometimes those changes had not been copy edited. So you had to learn what you could about New Yorker style to apply it.
And you had a big catch that really had an impact on your career.
Yes, early on when I was still training, I was on a desk called the Foundry proofreading desk, just helping and learning on the job. And I did catch, it was a Christmas list on food. And I found the word flour in a list of staples that you would have in the kitchen, and it was spelled F-L-O-W-E-R. So I very carefully drew the line out and put a U in there instead of the W-E. And it turned out that no one had caught that, that it had sailed through from manuscript almost to print.
And that was before spell check. Now I could understand that. I'm assuming spell check has affected the whole profession.
Well, not in that case. Spell check would never have caught that mistake.
Yeah, I understand. But do you use spell check?
I do. I would be arrogant not to use spell check. At one point, I always use spell check on an article I'm reading, yes.
Has that changed things? Are there fewer copy editors now than there were when you started?
No. As a matter of fact, I think there are more copy editors now than when I started.
The New Yorker has some peculiar affectations. Has that made spell check less useful for you than it might otherwise be?
Absolutely.
For example, the O diuresis, which everybody comments on, which is used in English words like zoology and cooperate to indicate that the two O's are pronounced separately. Not too many other people are doing that these days.
That is a mark, the diuresis, that has been left behind for the most part. We had used hyphens or the other stylus just to do without it and let people figure out themselves that it's cooperate and not cooperate.
I kind of know even without the diuresis,
right.
But yes. Mary Norris, her book, Between You and Me, Confessions of a Comic Queen, published by Norton. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with a conversation I had in April with Mary Norris. Her book, which is called Between You and Me, Confessions of a Comic Queen, is published by Norton, and we're rebroadcasting our conversation for you today. I continued our chat by asking, does it feel strange to talk about something you've written after going over other people's work for so many years?
Yes, yes, it is different being on the other side. Being criticized.
Having somebody else copy edit you.
That was interesting. I actually enjoyed it. It was interesting to see what my copy editor found, and also interesting to gauge my own reaction, you know, to see whether I was willing to be amenable, which I tried my best to be, and what things I couldn't really stand. That was interesting.
Well, it's been my sense that if a writer is very famous, not at the New Yorker, but elsewhere, they're less likely to get close copy editing. Late in Faulkner's career, you mentioned Faulkner. I've read one of his last books, and in the beginning of the book, a lot of words were hyphenated, and by the end of the book, they were compound words. And I'm sure you would have caught that, but I think they probably were afraid to tell him that he had been inconsistent. Consistency probably is an important part of what you are looking for.
It's true. You don't want to maintain a rigid consistency, but you want a word to be spelt the same way if it's used twice in a piece.
Who is Eleanor Gould, and what were the Gould proofs?
Eleanor Gould was the New Yorker's head grammarian and query proofreader, and she read everything in galley, that is, everything in that except fiction, she gave a reading to even before it was scheduled.
And why not fiction?
Because Eleanor tended to apply her own logic to everything, and she didn't give at least the writers of fiction. Some of them thought that she didn't give enough license to the voice of the fiction writer.
What's a wooden fix?
A wooden fix is when the change does not blend in with the voice of the writer. It just would be like a wooden knee in a leg, and it wouldn't bend the same way as the rest of the prose.
You edited John McPhee's piece in Suspect Terrain about the I-80, and there was a crisis?
Oh, well, there was a little bit of a crisis. He used an expression. He was describing some feature of geology, and he said that this was, that these things were new and far between. And it was just a crisis in my own mind. I thought that there was a possibility that John McPhee had meant the cliché, few and far between. And I had a hard time staying my hand and not changing that into few and taking his comma out. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized I was only the first copy editor on the piece, and there would be others coming along, and they could make sure. Whereas if I changed it and I was wrong, I would be very foolish.
What did it turn out to be?
It was as he wanted it. Uh-huh. It was new and far between.
But you did take the comma out. Commas are an important part. In fact, your subtitle here is Confessions of a Comma Queen. Do people use too many commas or too few?
Oh, I don't think you can use too few commas in some people's opinions. By the way, I did leave that comma in the McPhee, because there is something that people use for stylistic purposes. They might put an extra comma in that somebody else would take out. The New Yorker, as you know, is famous for close punctuation. We like a lot of commas.
Because they make things clearer, or is there an explanation for using all of those extra commas?
The idea is to make things clearer. It's to point out what is the most important part of the sentence, to subordinate some things in the sentence. We use the commas.
You made a catch in a Philip Roth piece early in your career. What were you working on, and how did he react?
Well, that was when some chapters of his book, I Married a Communist, ran in the New Yorker. The book had already been proofread and was about to go on to the market, I think, so there was not much for me to do. I was just enjoying reading Philip Roth, but I had to stay alert, and I had to go over it with the fine-tooth comb that we do. And I found a discrepancy. He had quoted, or the narrator had quoted, a passage from a children's history book, and then later in the story referred to that same passage, and there was a little discrepancy in the words. So I pointed that out and gave the proof to the editor, who was Bill Buford, and then Bill's assistant, who was named Sean Wilsey, came later and gave me a Xerox, a color Xerox, of my proof, on which Buford had written, "Philip Roth says of Mary Norris, who is this woman, and will she come live with me?"
Oh, that's nice.
It was very nice. It set me off on a Roth kick. I read everything I could get my hands on.
Well, Steven Pinker says that "whom" is used consistently only by careful writers and pretentious speakers. Does the New Yorker still feel it's important to make a distinction between who and whom? And are you allowing hopefully these days?
We still don't use hopefully, but we don't use it is to be hoped either. We just kind of avoid it. If we use whom, we're as careful as we can be to make sure it should be whom and not who. The mistake the other way, to use who for whom, is pretty acceptable.
Well, we do have the situation where the spoken language is often a lot looser than the written language.
Yes.
And we don't. But then when you're writing dialogue, you can write the dialogue in the spoken language.
That's
and
right.
Copy editors don't try to correct those things?
Well, we might have to have our arms strapped to our sides, but no, we try not to correct dialogue.
There was, for a long time during the Sean editorship, there were rules about what words could be used. Did that all change after he was no longer with the magazine?
It changed kind of gradually after Mr. Sean left, and he didn't like any reference to any bodily fluid, and he had other things he didn't like us mentioning.
Well, the four-letter words were not allowed.
Oh, no, of course not, and no fish hooks or blood or anything gross.
Wasn't that limiting?
I guess there were ways to write around it, and they were thought, actually, I think, that they were more inventive when they had to avoid those words, the writers. But it has loosened up a lot, so that now the magazine under David Remnick just goes ahead and prints the obscenities.
What about semicolons? This actually becomes a big issue. Why?
Well, Probably because most people don't know how to use semicolons. I think you only know how to use a semicolon if you have some kind of classical education. You know, people misuse them. They think of them as industrial strength commas and just put them in when the sentence is extra long.
Oh, I was thought that it just was a way of linking two sentences that you didn't want to present as separate because they followed the same thought.
Well, that's a good way to think of it. But a lot of people forget that the thing that follows the semicolon has to be a complete sentence as it is.
And
itself.
Eleanor Gould had a rule that the semicolon could not follow a dash.
Yes, the dash was too informal. A punctuation mark to hold up a sentence that was also full of a semicolon.
You must have some reference books that you have to rely on.
Well, Webster's, Merriam-Webster's
Collegiate Only Webster's, Dictionary. Webster's? You know, wouldn't you use American Heritage or one of the others?
We favor Webster's. It's the great American dictionary. And somebody said recently to me that the American Heritage we don't have, really. We don't need a usage panel because we can just go out in the hall and say, hey, what would you do with this verb? You know, we are a usage panel unto ourselves.
Pauline Kael had a fight with Sean over one of those words we were talking about. And you say that the writers hired by Sean in the mid-70s were puzzled by some of the prohibitions.
Well, some of them were.
Did they all try to fight for their words?
I believe so. Or they all tried to write around them. I know Pauline Kael fought. There's a story about Calvin Trillin fighting. And if it was germane to the story, William Sean had to really give it some thought and give the writer the permission to use the word.
You say that you have something against eraser-tipped pencils. What's wrong with having an eraser at the top of the pencil?
I don't really have anything against. I'm more interested in the point of the pencil and the grade of the lead or graphite than I am in
like
the
eraser.
You like a dark eraser.
Lead or are you standard number two?
Like a soft lead. A soft lead is a number one lead.
Mm. So there you are. Using your number one on computers today, is that even necessary? You can always just underscore things or put them in color or do all sorts of other things.
Still, we like to work in pencil on paper. You know, it's a lot more sensuous.
And you can find a number one at an art supply store, I imagine.
You can, or you can order them online. There's a huge online pencil community.
The book's gotten wonderful reviews so far. You think people are afraid of you?
Oh, I hope not. I don't think so. I'm pretty approachable.
Mary Norris began working at The New Yorker in 1978. Her book, Between You and Me, Confessions of a Comic Queen, is published by Norton. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure.